Welcome to Make Your Shit, a podcast about empowering creatives like yourself to overcome obstacles, the real ones and the ones you imagine, to push through moments of doubt and indecision, to find the joy in the work that you want to do, and ultimately, to give yourself permission to make the shit that you want to make. I'm your host, Kyle F. Andrews. I'm a screenwriter, actor, producer, and creative advocate. I've spent the better part of the last decade helping artists, industry pros, and people who didn't necessarily see themselves as creatives take strides to break into the business, hone their skills, and most importantly, find their voice in an industry that just doesn't want to listen. On today's show, I sit down with writer-director Nathan Hale Williams and chat about his recently Emmy-nominated project, All Boys Aren't Blue. We'll discuss his approach to overcoming barriers in the creative and production process, his no assholes policy, and how and why you should try to build a positive relationship with the word no. If you'd like to support the show, click that follow button, share us with your friends, and give us a shout out on Instagram and Twitter at MYS Podcast. If you'd like to follow me, I'm on Instagram at Kyle F. Andrews. Nathan Hale Williams is an award-winning filmmaker, a best-selling author, an entertainment attorney, and president and CEO of Inhale Entertainment. Nathan is a classic storyteller across multiple genres and media. He may be best known for his award-winning short film, 90 Days, which was screened at over 35 top festivals, receiving multiple best awards, including an African Movie Academy Award and overall winner at the Cannes Diversity Showcase. In 2022, Nathan was invited and selected for Story 27's Writers' Colony with Mara Brock-Akil for the industry's most promising emerging screenwriters. His last film, All Boys Aren't Blue, won a GLAAD Media Award, two Telly Awards, an inaugural Anthem Award, Best Narrative Feature at Newfest Film Festival, and was recently nominated for a Daytime Emmy Award. He is currently in development on his feature script, Love Will Save the Day. I love talking to Nathan. I have had the privilege to talk to Nathan many times over the last several years of our friendship. Nathan, as we will discuss, directed me in a short film a few years ago called Burden. I have loved every moment of working with Nathan. He is such an open creative. He is accepting of others' feedback while also knowing the direction he wants to go. So enjoy. Nathan, I am so happy to have you on the show today. Thanks for being on.
Of course. I'm so happy to be here. You're one of my favorite people.
Feeling is mutual. You're also one of my favorite artists to work with, because I would say that you were the most active person. The listeners would have heard it earlier, but once again, you make movies, you are a film director, you're a film producer, you're a documentary filmmaker, you are an author who has written books, you've been a lawyer, you've done a lot. How do you find the time to be creative while you are also trying to get business done?
Well, that's such an interesting question, Kyle, because it is an ongoing balancing act, right? Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why I retired in January 2022 from practicing entertainment law was because of that very reason, that I could not balance my legal brain and my creative brain in the same day, right? You know, so if I was a lawyer one day, I couldn't go and write a script later on, or vice versa, you know? And I found that it was a bit of a crutch, you know? So I thankfully didn't have to wait tables and all of that while I was building up my creative portfolio. But at the same time, it wasn't allowing me to create at my highest potential. And so it's difficult, you know? Over the years, I did take a break in between. You know, I was a producer for a very long time, and I produced a bunch of TV shows and films. And then there was a pause. It looks like, if you look at my IMDb, there was a pause. Like, what did he do between then? Well, I wrote 5 books. Mm. And so, you know, as Oprah says, you can have it all, just not all at once. It's an ongoing balancing act for me to do all of the things that I have in my spirit to do. But I think I'm getting a handle on it.
I love that. I especially love that you brought up Oprah for a very specific reason. It's because, you know, growing up in Wisconsin myself, the WGN area was Oprah's town. And I know that you are from Chicago. Did growing up in Chicago lead you to where you got now? How did being a native Chicagoan bring you to where you are today?
Well, I steal a line from my forever first lady, Michelle Obama. We actually went to the same high school, Whitney Young
Magnet right.
High School in the greater city of Chicago. Go Mighty Dolphins. I steal a line from her because it just encapsulates everything. She says, you know, I'm from the south side of Chicago, and that tells you everything you need to know about me. Mm. Packed in there is that I came from a firmly middle class African-American family. My mother was a social worker that worked her way up to being the deputy director of the state Department of Children and Family Services. Mm-hmm. My father was a physical education teacher and basketball coach who became a pastor, a Baptist preacher. And, you know, I grew up with those Midwestern Black values, you know, family first and above everything. But I also had two parents that told me that I could do anything, and I believed them. Mm. And then just the growing up on the South Side of Chicago, I say this about Chicagoans, we are probably some of the most down-to-earth, easygoing, relatable people that you will meet. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I run my life, and that's the way I run my business. So I steal that line from my fellow Mighty Dolphin, First Lady Michelle Obama, that I'm from the South Side of Chicago, and that tells you everything you need to know about me.
I have learned probably a lot about the South Side of Chicago just from knowing you. I actually, personally, I love Chicago. But obviously, Chicago and Los Angeles are somewhat different cities. How have you found moving to Los Angeles to lead you to your creativity, or kind of has it gotten in the way at all? What's been your experience moving here?
Well, you know, I think it's important to talk about the journey here. Mm. So I left Chicago when I was 17 to go to school, to go to undergrad. And then I went to grad school, law school in D.C. And then I moved to New York. And then while in law school, I lived in Miami. So I've lived in Chicago, D.C., Miami, New York for almost 15 years. And then I moved to Los Angeles. Mm. And I moved to Los Angeles. And when I lived in New York, it was the center of the universe. I thought I would never leave. I loved it. And I did not move here because I wanted to. I moved here because I thought I had to, because I had made the switch from being a producer to being a writer-director. And the opportunities to expand my career just were greater here in Los Angeles. And people were telling me, you need to be in LA, you need to be in LA. So I begrudgingly moved here because I did not like LA. I would come, my best friend Andrea, my best friend of my whole life, would also always pray over my trips to LA because something catastrophic would happen every time I came to visit here. So LA was not one of my favorite places. And so I moved here out of duty and not out of desire. But then I got here, and at the later stage in my life, it's the perfect place for me because I have developed a practice that allows me a peace of mind, a quality of life that allows me to create. New York is so busy. I'm like, how did I ever live here? It's busy, it's dirty, it's something going on, it's expensive. I don't think that I would have as much space to create in New York that I do in Los Angeles. I spend an hour in meditation and prayer every day, which allows me to maneuver and deal with the craziness of our business in a way that allows me to stay calm and sane. I don't think I would have that space in New York City. But, and then you can't beat the weather. I'm so spoiled now. I love LA, and I've met some great people here, and this is where I have become who I am now as a creator, which is a writer, director, producer.
I find it really interesting that the thing that you talked about that has helped you settle in LA is how you approach the morning. How important is being settled inside your own personal artistic essence before you try to do things, as opposed to trying to find it slapdash as you get out there?
I wouldn't trade in my 15 years in New York for anything. It was the it was amazing training ground for being an indie creator, right? You know, it really is the city. If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. It taught me grit and grind in a way. I mean, because the best of the best are in New York, and they work their tails off. They party hard too, but they work their tails off. And it taught me, it gave me a medal to my personality and my working spirit that I have brought to LA. Now, what LA has done for me is allow me space to be, to pause and be still and hear my voice and discover my voice. Because I've been writing since I was 8 years old. In the 1980s, you know, for a Black boy from the South Side of Chicago, being a filmmaker or a writer was not a career path. There was no one I could look up to. There was no internet. So I didn't know that there was Oscar Micheaux. I didn't know there was Melvin Van Peebles. Spike Lee didn't come along until I was, you know, at the end of my high school career, you know. So there was no rubric or no role models for me to look up to and say, that's what I want to do as a career. So I got to this a little bit later, because I didn't even know that it was a possibility. So what LA has allowed me to do is to be still and to be in quiet, and also find what my voice is and actually do the work of revising and finding it and getting into my rhythm and understanding what I want to say about the world and my work that I would not have been able to do in New York. And I think the marriage of the two experiences has made, you know, allowed me to be successful.
Finding your voice in silence is something that folks who are used to speaking so much don't often find, especially when the rooms get louder, you have to really dig into your own voice. The creative process needs those moments of stillness. At the same time, there are still barriers, I assume, in getting your stuff through. Barriers you had when you were 8 are different, I'm sure, than the barriers you have now, but how do you deal with barriers in the industry when you face them?
I honestly don't see barriers. I don't even contemplate an obstacle. You know, there's a phrase that I learned in college is that obstacles are those frightful things that you can see when you lose sight of the goal, right? Mm-hmm. And mind you, my experience is a little bit different. I was an entertainment lawyer for 22 years. Mm-hmm. I lived and moved in, you know, very wealthy, I wasn't wealthy, but very wealthy sections of New York Black society, Black elite. So I know people who are connected to money and resources, and money for me has never been the issue. You know, I think that's a big barrier for many people. But I honestly don't, when I set out to do something, I don't think about what's going to stop me. I think about how do I do it? And I figure out a way to do it. And so I really honest, and that's not even like a cookie cutter, you know, interview answer. That's literally the way I see the world.
Yeah, it feels legit.
Yeah, and if I say that I'm going to do it, it's going to get done. It might not happen on the schedule that I want it to happen, but I don't think that there's a barrier. I don't think there's anybody that can stop me from doing what I want to do.
When it comes to the typical getting stuff made in Hollywood, has it turned out the way that you expected it to? Has it blown your mind in how easy or how difficult it's been? Because you've gotten a lot of projects off the ground. If I went to your IMDb right now, I would see a lot of projects lined up. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that you are in a pipeline now? Or is it still like each individual project is its own set of challenges?
I don't think that I am in the pipeline, so to speak, in the traditional pipeline. I still very much feel like I am a disruptor doing things on my own outside of the system in a way that no one else is doing it, right? The way I've gotten my projects funded are in non-traditional ways. And even my current projects, you know, now I'm at the point where I'm now pitching to studios and I have projects that have been greenlit at studios. And I find that extremely difficult because I'm used to being in the driver's seat. And I'm used to, for instance, I sold a television show that I wrote. And we sold it to a studio, a major studio. And then they got a pilot order from a network, a major cable network. And then, you know, everything was going along great. And then in December, that major cable network decided to go in a different direction. So I'm not used to that. I'm not used to somebody telling me, no, I can't, because I do it on my own. I just signed a deal for another television show, an unscripted show, where, you know, I was negotiating with the studio and they were basically trying to tell me that I was, you know, going to have a producer credit and not, that was it and go away. And I was like, absolutely not. You know, I created the show. Now, mind you, my partners are two big A-list name talent on it, but it's my show. And I was not giving up until I got everything I wanted. And so, and I was okay to walk away from it because I knew that that was not going to stop me. Oprah Winfrey, you know, she's in this interview for 60 minutes and she says, talking about the Oprah Winfrey show before it became what it was at the beginning. She says, you know, I know it'll do well. And then I think it was one of those famous 60 minutes interviewers said, well, what if it doesn't do well? She says, I will still do well. And that's how I feel about it, you know? So I don't feel like I'm quite, I don't have a manager. I don't have an agent. I've never had that. Because I feel like, why am I going to give somebody a percentage of stuff when I'm going to have to go and shake the trees on my own anyway? I do have a lawyer. I do have an accountant. You know, I have a business manager now, but that's more on the speaking branding side. But yeah, I've done it outside of the pipeline and outside of the system. But I do have a plan on how to become that, you know, because I feel like because I'm older, because of the kinds of stories I want to tell, I know that I have to show them first, right? Mm-hmm. With my film 90 Days, which is a short film about HIV and AIDS, if I had taken that to the traditional entertainment pipelines, they would have laughed at me. You know, meanwhile, that film has been around the world and won a gazillion awards and is still making money. You know, if I had taken that to a studio, first of all, it's a 19-minute film mm-hmm. that I still make money from, you know, wow. because that's another thing that I think is important. And Vivica Fox, who is a friend of mine, told me maybe 15 years ago, she said, baby, this is show biz. And the more you know about the biz, the more you get to show.
Oh, that's great.
And so the reason why I built strong relationships, particularly with financiers and investors, is one, I pay them back. I make money off of short films and, you know, people are making money off of big films. And then two, as the current financier of the film I'm about to do, you know, he was like, you win awards, you know, and I want to win awards. So you got to know what you bring to the table. You got to understand the business. And sometimes you got to be outside of the system to get them to notice you and show them first.
I think a lot of folks who would be listening to this show have the creative angle down. They know what they want to say. They know what they want to get out there. They have the motivation to do it. They just don't know how to approach somebody and say, hey, can you give me some money so that I can make this? How do you approach financiers? Is it nerve-wracking for you? Have you gotten settled? What's the best approach in getting financiers on board with you?
So my grandfather, Big Daddy, God rest his soul, I called him Big Daddy because he was bigger than my grandfather, my dad, and so my mother called him Daddy, so he was my Big Daddy. He was my role model of what it meant to be a great man. But he used to say, you're going to get one of two answers, yes or no. And if you don't ask the question, it's going to be no. And so I think that people have to get over asking for money, like being scared to ask for money, because people with money are used to people asking them for money. And so if you have a relationship with them or if you don't have a relationship with them, you asking them for money to fund a project is not going to mess up the relationship or it's not going to preclude you from building a relationship because they're used to people asking them for money. So you have to get over the fear of asking folks for money. Secondly, you have to develop a healthy relationship with the word no, right?
Oh, wow.
And
you just blew my mind for a second.
Yeah. And so, because once you develop a healthy relationship with the word no, it doesn't gut you when you get them. Because you're going to get more no's than you get yeses, right? And in this business, the predominance of no's, it's a very uneven, let's just say that. But once you develop a healthy relationship with the word no, it empowers you to not be afraid of getting the no, right? Not expecting the no. I expect a yes. I expect everyone to say yes to me, right? And then when they don't say yes, I'm like, either I'll show them or you're crazy for saying no, or you will see you're crazy for saying no. But I don't take the no personally. You know, the four agreements, don't take things personally, don't make assumptions, that stuff. I don't take the no personally. I just saying they're not the right person, not the right time, or the better yes is waiting for me. And so I don't take no's personally and I don't let it deter me or hurt me in a way that stops me. In terms of financiers, the way I approach them is everybody wants some kind of value from what they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone is self-centered. And rightfully so. We talk about self-love or whatever, and people use the word self-centered in a way that I think is negative, which I don't use it that way. I don't use the word ego in a negative way. I don't use the word self-centered. You are the most important person in your life, right? So you have to approach people with a value proposition that means something to them. And you have to fit your job as a creator is to figure out, if I'm talking to Kyle, what are Kyle's values and what about this project are going to speak to Kyle's values? And that's how I pitch the project to Kyle. Right?
And it's not BS, you're not making it up because it's already in the project for you. You're just finding the appropriate narrow hallway down which to walk it.
Exactly. And if I'm looking at Kyle and my project does not align with Kyle's values, I shouldn't approach Kyle for any money. You know what I mean? Because just give me some money because I'm talented does not work. Mm. You know, and so you're either appealing to someone's sense of altruism, you're either appealing to someone's their bottom line, that I can make you money. That's the easiest way to get money. Or you're appealing to something that they care about and something that they value. And you hone in on that and you connect that part of your project to their values. And you will increase your chances of getting to that yes.
You are writing, you are producing, you are directing. If you had to choose one of those three to focus on right now, is there one that you could focus on all of your energies? Or do you need to be all three in order to keep your project going?
At this point, I need to be all three. Mm-hmm. Because I'm such a damn good producer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And no one does it like I do. And in terms of the executive producing part, I am glad to give over the nuts and bolts, the onset, the moving, and that production work. And I have a team of producers for my upcoming film that will handle all of that. But moving the project forward, no one is going to give it the same attention and energy that I am going to give it at this point. I will happily, see that part of my job to someone else when I feel like I have people on board who can do it in the same way that I do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The writing, directing to me is the same job to me. Because, and I often tell people, ask me to produce other people, their stuff or direct their stuff. And I'm at the point in my career right now that I have too much to say of my own. And I am not one of those people that can write a baby and give it away. Because as I'm writing it, I am directing it. Maybe I'll get to that point. But at this point, the writing for me is so that I can direct it.
Mm.
I view those as one job. The producing part, I would gladly give up. You know what I mean? Because that shit is, excuse me. That's, I guess
the show's called Make Your Shit.
That shit is, it's taxing. And I would love to just create and be creative, but the writing, directing, I view as one job.
Mm.
The reason why I don't mind talking about projects that I have that I'm developing, and I'm talking about projects that are far along, not things that are in my brain, ideas,
sure.
Is because I have found time and time again that I'll post something. I've done like 4 crowdfunding campaigns and only one of them has met its goal. This most recent one for Love Will Save the Day. But every last one of them, I have gotten someone who has given me a significant amount of money because they saw the crowdfunding campaign, mm-hmm. outside of the crowdfunding campaign. I've had an actor approach me that I never would have known. You know what I mean? And so I created opportunities by sharing what I was doing. Rich people, wealthy people, Steven Spielberg can move in silence. He gets that opportunity. You know what I mean? He has that privilege because he's Steven Spielberg. But when you're on the come up, you have to tell people about what you're making. You have to tell people about what you're doing because you never know, especially with social media, you never know when the right person is going to see it and create an opportunity for you.
Is that not the truth or what? You cannot get somebody interested if you don't give them the option to be interested in the first place.
Right. And I'm from a metaphysical standpoint, because I'm into all that shit, you've given me license to share.
Hey, roll with it. Let's do it. Let's do both.
Yeah, yeah. Is once you move forward, that is energy letting the universe know that you have activated. And the universe, as Paulo Coelho says, one of my favorite authors, the universe rises up to conspire and conspires in your favor, right? And it rises up to meet you. And so by activating that outward energy, you're telling the universe, I am ready. Ooh, I just got to chew. I am ready for it, right? And, mm-hmm. and that you're in alignment with the pathway forward, and the universe always is conspiring in your favor.
And you know what? As artists, we need to lean into that because we need other people to work with us to create something. And fate throws people in your way that it feels will either help you move forward, help you grow, or help you realize that you don't need them. So let's talk a little bit about that, because our first experience together was working on a film. Mm-hmm. You were a writer, producer, and director of Burden. I was an actor in it. My official title was Soccer Man, and mm-hmm. I had my Irish accent on that I won't do right now too much, but it was a blast.
Well, you gave me several accents.
I think
options.
I had a Swiss option in there too.
No, you gave me like three options. I was so impressed.
Well, thank you. Well, when I came on, you know, as an actor, coming onto a set is always of people that you don't know. How much do I need to perform to make these people like me? Do I even need to make these people like me? Coming onto your set, you just made all of that wash over me, and I just performed with a fellow collaborator. In finding the collaborations that you've walked forward with, what do you look for in the people that fate puts in your way?
So I start off with this, and someone I dated criticized me for it because he used to be in like human resources. But I tell people from the jump, especially when I'm interviewing producers and crew, I have a zero assholes rule. I feel that
it's a good rule.
Yeah, and I say it up front. I feel that this is a blessing that we get to be in this business. This is a blessing that we get to create art and entertainment and make money from it, right? And so we're not trying to cure cancer. We are trying to save the world, but this is not something where you get to be a jerk, and you don't get to be a jerk on my set. I want to work really, really hard to get to the best of excellence, but I also want to have a good ass time. Mm. I want people to leave my set saying, that was a good experience. I feel good about that. Not necessarily about me, but about the experience. Because one, you get better work from people.
For sure.
When they're having a good time and they feel appreciated and they feel like their voice and their input and their thoughts about things and their creativity matters, right? You just create a better stew. And then two, went back to metaphysics. The energy you put out is the energy you get back. I can always tell from watching a movie when they did not get along on set. I can feel it in the movie. Feel when the director was a jerk. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And I don't ever want that feeling on my films. Burden, the film that you were in, is a great example of a learning moment, right? Mm. One of my superpower is my belief in myself. You know, this thing that my mother drove home, my father, and not to the extent of my mother, but my mother drove home, and then my other family reinforced that I could do anything, right? That year that I was doing Burden, that superpower, my S on my chest was crooked, right? Mm. And I had some people who I hired based on recommendation, and I went against my own insight that, you know, were in film school, they were getting their MFA, they were doing this thing, and they thought they knew better than me. Mm. And my insecurity, because I didn't go to film school, I was a lawyer teaching himself how to do all of this, right? Made me second guess myself a lot on that set. And so I felt like I had not put out my best work with that film. Mind you, I just licensed that film again to another, like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I've been doing since 2019 or 20, I've been doing diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, programs with major Fortune 100 companies.
It's become a teaching tool.
Yes, yeah. I make a whole bunch of money from that film. But because of the experience, because I let some assholes on my set who second-guessed me and my vision, I doubted myself. And I went into this little depression and went away to Mexico to find myself in. The lesson that I learned was trust your gut and stick with your rule of no assholes, no matter how accomplished someone is and no matter how good they are at their job. It's especially when you are the leader, you know, you need people around you that are rooting for you and not second guessing you.
That is a good way to protect yourself in this business. This business does have its attack dogs, and it does have its minor catastrophes that spiral out of control. And sometimes as artists, we feel like we have to lean into the work itself to control it. But as a producer, the work is the whole movie. When you are finding those stressful moments, do you ever find that you are now losing a day to that kind of stress, or do you lose a moment and you can compartmentalize it and learn from it and move on?
That's a great question. Where I am right now, it's a blip. You know what I mean? Like, I was thinking about Love Will Save the Day, a film that you will be in, that you are cast in already. I was thinking about Love Will Save the Day and my gigantic vision for this film, right? And, you know, there are moments like, Nathan, who the hell do you think you are, right? But it's just a moment now. And since burden and moving in to All Boys Aren't Blue and doing the feature documentary that I did and all the lessons that I learned, I know that, one, I don't have to know it all. Steven Spielberg talks about this. He said, I'd rather have someone who doesn't know anything about the mechanics of anything on set but can tell a good story. And I know I can tell a damn good story, right? And so I don't doubt myself in that same way. The moments of humanness, my humanness that creep in, they're literally blips. Mm-hmm. And I remind myself that I can do it. But more importantly, I know how to surround myself with people who are brilliant.
Well, it sounds like you don't take the humanity out of it. It sounds like you actually embrace who you are as a person, allow that to be the rock upon which you stabilize yourself, and then you move forward through kind of the storm that's hitting you. Did you like that analogy? I think I went a little
far. No, that was a great summation. That's exactly the truth. And because we're going to be human, right? We're going to have those moments of doubt. I think that you feel like there's a moment where you hit nirvana with all of this stuff. And I don't think you ever do. I mean, and really, this is why I tell people, my niece, my little mini me, her name is Jaden, and she's my goddaughter too, wants to be a director, and I'm training her. And I told her, I said, honey, the best thing you can do is watch great movies. So we've been watching movies at the same time. I said, and then study the greats. And listen to them and listen to their journey, read their biographies, and you'll find that the things that you are, that are, you think are unique to you, are commonalities amongst all great people. And so once you realize that all great people have these moments, your moment stays a lot less. It doesn't stay there long.
Do you have any books that really helped you with that? Any, whether they're industry books or outside the industry books?
Oh my God. I read about 20 books a year. So one I just read was Matthew McConaughey's book, Green Lights. And I loved it. I loved the book. I loved it so much. I recommended it to everybody, including my mother. And the reason why I loved it is because Matthew McConaughey was someone who came to filmmaking kind of the way I did. You know, he was a good looking guy. Someone was like, do you want to be on set? He had one line, that big movie that he made his debut in.
Dazed and Confused, I think.
And he turned this one line into this big thing. But he's also very spiritual and metaphysical. And he's, you know, he's concerned about the world. And I think he talks about the story about Dallas Buyers Club, you know, this movie about HIV and this lead character. And he said he got the script. Someone else was going to do the film, right? And then they backed out of it. And so he got the script. He had no director. He had no money. Well, he said, you know, let's say he got the script in January. He started telling people, I'm making this movie in August. Mm-hmm. He didn't have any money. He didn't have a director, whatever. And he made the movie in August or somewhere there and abouts. So the reason why I love that book is because he talks about the times in your life when the light turns green, right? And you get the sign from the universe that you are moving in the right direction. Because if you pay attention in the stillness, one of the reasons why I love being in LA is because I have time to hear the things that are happening and process things. The universe will put up a stop sign with people, places, things, events, or it'll put up a green light. And you have to, when it puts that green light on, you better get ready to go. He had these unconventional ways of approaching his art, right? He talked about how when he thought he was going to be, he was like, I need to be more serious about this acting thing. And he went and started taking, you know, Uta Hagen and all those courses and method. And he said he was horrible. And then he realized that there was some innate natural ability that he had that he had to get back down to the core. Like he talks about this one world he was preparing for. And he said his MO to prepare for it was to drink tequila, do 3 shots of tequila, and then go running barefoot in the desert for like 2 hours or whatever. He was like, yeah, that worked for about 3 days. But just that his approach to throwing it on the wall and seeing what stuck to things is kind of, you know, I do it a little bit more methodically than he does because I'm not as of a free spirit. I love that book. And then one more book is Diane Carroll's book, The Legs Are the Last to Go, just about a Black woman breaking down barriers and never seeing, like you talk about these barriers, never seeing barriers. because, you know, she called up Aaron Spelling. She'd been watching Dynasty, and she was like, she said, you need a black bitch. And she said it just like that. And she was like, and I want to be the first black bitch on television.
Wow.
Like, what kind of cojones?
That's amazing.
You know what I mean? What kind of cojones? You know, and, you know, she has this interview. If you don't follow her Instagram, it's not her. It's called Queen Diane. Someone did it. All these interviews. And she says in one of the interviews, she's like, yeah, when people tell me no, I'm like, well, what's wrong with these people? You know what I mean? Like, why are you telling me no? You can't be possibly talking about me.
I love the places you get inspiration from because I see that they affect who you are and the art that you make. But I would also say that you are in a point where I know you are inspiring a lot of people. What is it like to be a source of inspiration for creatives? And do you feel you have a responsibility to the people who are still coming up behind you?
I find that to be one of the most important parts of my purpose and mission, particularly for people who look like me, you know, being black and gay. Coming from the South Side of Chicago, this business is not set up for me. Being older, when more mature, when I decided to become a writer director, this in this, you know, youth obsessed world, let alone this youth obsessed business, is not set up for me. But one of my idols and mentors, Mara Brock Akil, who I had, you know, had the pleasure of being in her writer's colony, her second cohort of her writer's colony, says, you know, you lift as you climb. So when people tell me that I inspire them or their journey, I work with a guy, Nasir, now who's like my little brother, who's my right hand. And the way we came to work together is he sent me an email or a DM or something like that years ago. And he was just like, I admire what you've done in the business. And at this point, I didn't think I had done anything, you know, really. And you inspired me to come and do this business. And now he's, you know, he's one of my right hands. That means almost as much as the work itself, you know, because that means that there will be so many more stories to tell. And there's so many more stories that we haven't seen before. Shonda Rhimes, who I look up to, you know, talks about representation and seeing yourself on television. And her job is to show different people so that other people can see themselves. Because once you see yourself doing something, it becomes a possibility for you. So I take that part of my job very seriously. And I like today I posted something on Instagram that I had a day yesterday. I had a moment, like I cried, you know, I was overwhelmed. Thankfully I have warrior angels around me that, you know, can help me through that moment. But I felt it was my duty to share, you know, about that. And that, you know, that even though outside, you know, recently Emmy nominated, things look like they're going great, but shit can be fucked up too.
That's right. You have an Emmy nomination now for All Boys Aren't Blue. So where does this sit for you?
So it's twofold again. So on the business side of it, I was in the middle of a negotiation that was with the studio I was telling you that was trying to play me, and I became Emmy nominated and the price went up. And I was like, stop playing me. And they doubled my money and gave me everything that I wanted. It did have a business effect.
That's amazing.
I will forever be Emmy nominated director producer. That will never change. Personally, it reminded me that my quest to be an EGOT is not fantasy, right? Because I'm one step closer. And then personally, you know, it just gave me a boost of confidence that I know what I'm doing. And I'm on the right. It was that green light, like Matthew McConaughey said. You know what I mean? Like, it was a green light. It was like, keep going. And then also, it was just really cool because my mom and my family, they don't know. I'm the first Emmy nominated person that they know, you know what I mean, directly.
It's a
big
change.
I think about people that who have been friends of mine for a long, like I'm really good friends with Shirley Ralph, and I've known her for 20 years, and she just got her first one in her 60s, you know, and
hopefully the first of many.
I do good shit, you know what I mean? Like for instance, my feature film documentary, no one will ever see it because I don't like it. And you know what I mean? And so it's the one thing that I'm like, and my business partner, Richard, is like, no, I love it, Nathan. I was like, I don't care that you love it. I don't like it. And so you'll never see it.
You need to be able to have a realistic relationship with all of your projects.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's not me being like how I was with Burden at first or whatever. It's really not what what I wanted to say. I had limited resources, and it did not come out the way I wanted it to come out. And so, but for the most part, I do really excellent work, because that's always the goal. And so I'm not surprised. You know, they just postponed the Emmys because of the writer's strike, which mm-hmm. I anticipated. I have a strong feeling that we'll win. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I have visualized holding that statue in my hand and putting it next to the rest of the statues. I will use this nomination and hopefully this win as a reminder that I'm on the right path, but not as a, oh, okay, we're done now. Mm-hmm. You know, because now I want a primetime Emmy nomination and win. Then I want an Oscar. Then I want a, you know, Grammy. I'm not quite sure how I've figured out the Grammy part yet. And, you know, but it's, you know, my therapist once asked me, you know, is that important? And she had me thinking it wasn't important, but it is important because it's a goal I set for myself and it's an attainable goal for me.
Can you find satisfaction without the awards?
Yeah, I find satisfaction without the awards. You know, the awards are nice. The awards are not, I would say they're not validation, they're confirmation. Does that make sense?
It absolutely. There's a difference. I think that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, so they're just confirming what I already know. When I finished All Boys Aren't Blue and I watched the final past, you know, viewing of it, I was like, did that. And it didn't matter what anybody else thought about it. That's when I know that I've done my best work, is because then it doesn't matter what other people think.
Wow. And it takes a lot of work to get to the point of self-confidence, but it's like your voice meets with what you intended for the voice to be. So it's nice to know that you're there.
And you've seen this.
I have seen it. And that's exactly what I wanted to get to, because Love Will Save the Day is such a remarkable script. You and I worked on it. Of course, you're the writer. I'm just there as a guide point.
No, you were you are invaluable, amazing script doctor, consultant, whatever you want to call yourself. But I feel like you are you were my partner in the evolution of it.
Now, I hate bringing it up, but we talked before about this, and you had to do a page one rewrite on the script. What was the process of doing that like for you? And in hindsight now, how did it turn out?
You know, as I said, I was invited and accepted into Mara Brackenkiel's writer's colony. And I developed Love Will Save the Day in that. And so basically, Mara has created this oasis and this sanctuary for writers to come and write. And that's purely what it is, and to give feedback and to give instruction and encouragement and support for writers to write. And a part of the culmination of that is to do a table read. And at the time, I was all over the place. Like the world was opening back up, so I was flying here because I make a lot of my money doing speaking. And I was flying here and doing this and doing that. And I was not focused on the script in a way that I should have been. And also, I was trying to be funny, and forgot that I'm actually naturally funny, you know, and
it's amazing how that works.
Yeah. Right. You know what I mean? And just the way the universe works, I didn't have time to cast it. And this is not against those actors that were in the table read. So I kind of threw some actors together. I didn't have time to rehearse and all this kind of stuff. And in the middle of the table read, because it was still virtual, I closed my computer and cried. I believe in crying. I believe in tears. It's a release. It's an energy release. It's an energy shift and change. And one of my cohort members, she's also from Chicago, Yvette, was behind me. And she was like, no, it's not that bad. And I was like, no, it's bad to me. That is not the way my work is supposed to sound. And then part of the process was that we met with Mara, and Mara was giving me notes. And I said, you know, I appreciate the notes. I said, but that's not the script. That's not my movie. And she was like, no, Nathan, it's not bad. You know, you got work to do, but it's not bad. I said, I appreciate that, Mara, but that's not the movie I want to make. And I'm going to start over. And she was like, well, that's really bold and courageous. I was like, I'd rather start over than make a bad movie. So I started over in last April 2022. And I wrote the first like 30 pages, and I knew that we were moving in the right direction, but then life started happening. And then in June, I had this random meeting with a guy that I've known for a long time who works at this company. And he was like, I want to finance your film, Love Will Save the Day. And I was like, oh, well, a little thing. It's not ready yet. I haven't finished the script. And I kind of like fudged on how much I had not finished the script. But it gave me the impetus to dig in. And then from like July to October, I wrote the current script. And then we went through revisions and tweaking it. And then it got to a point in January, I went away for the New Year's and I came back, I did one rewrite. And then I started sending out before then. And I haven't touched the script since January, because it's at a point where I don't care if other people don't like it, because I love it. Now, I am going to do a polish and a rewrite before we start shooting it, because there's things that have happened in life that I want to add, and I've gotten notes that I think are good or whatever. But I got it to a place where I no longer cared if anybody else liked it, because it was saying what I wanted it to say. So it was worth it. It was worth it. It's attracted major stars. Sherry Shepherd is attached. Pauletta Washington is attached.
It's exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. And even, you know, the couple of talent that has passed on it for whatever reason, it has not been because of the script. They've all loved the script, and they've all thought the script was beautiful, and they've all thought the message was beautiful. That's the foundation of any great movie, is a script, you know? And that other script would not have made a great movie. And so, yes, it was worth it.
Well, I want you to know that I absolutely love the script. I think it is hilarious, and I cannot wait for people listening to be able to watch the film once the long process of making the film is done. Yeah. And now that the script is done, do you feel like you have a good trajectory for getting the film out there and made?
Yeah, we're in final discussions to, you know, I got a commitment from this financier that I've been talking to since June. And now they're just internally going through the process to solidify the millions of dollars that we need to make this movie, which in of itself is unbelievable, that what this movie is going to cost, and like no one's blinking at it, and I'm like, can I do that? Yeah, I can do that. And so it's imminent. We will shoot this film this year, hook or crook.
I am so thrilled for you, Nathan. That's incredible and much deserved. Thank you for coming by, Nathan, and I really appreciate the candor and the kindness with which you spoke today. Thanks
Nathan. Thanks for having me, Kyle.
If you'd like to support the show, click that follow button, share us with your friends, and give us a shout out on Instagram and Twitter at MYS Podcast. If you'd like to follow me, I'm on Instagram at Kyle F. Andrews. For those listeners who'd like to go the extra mile and help me make this shit, we also have a no-pressure Patreon over at patreon.com/MYS Podcast. You can find these links and more in our show notes. I'm your host, Kyle F. Andrews. My consulting producer is Emily Castro. Our theme song is Keep On Dancing by Monday Hope. Until next time, keep making that shit.